This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Early Modern History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Elspeth Curry, your host today on the channel. This afternoon, we'll be talking to Dr. Jane Stevenson about her new book, Women and Latin in the Early Modern Period, a wonderful account of what and why women learned Latin in early modern Europe and how that relationship changed over time. Jane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So to get us started, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more of your own history.
Yes. Well, I went up to Cambridge in 1978, which was the 300th anniversary of the first woman to take a PhD, incidentally. But I went to study Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic. And when I got there, I'd sort of lost interest in Beowulf and started getting interested in insular Latin. Now, that means that I sort of approach Latin as a post-classical person. And the other thing is that working in that quite obscure and remote field, it became quite clear to me that those masses of stuff that nobody had even edited, let alone studied properly, it was a field where you sort of took it for granted that you could go to archives and find things. So when I later started getting interested in women's writing, I thought, well, you know, you just go out and look. You don't take it for granted that nothing's there just because everybody tells you nothing's there. So I think that's really the sort of important reason of how I got onto all this stuff.
Wonderful. I love the idea of going out and looking and finding out what has actually survived, because there's often so much more than we might think. So that's how you started with Latin. And what kind of brought you to the early modern world? What was it about women and Latin in this particular time period that has caught your interest?
Well, when I was in Cambridge, I took Peter Drunker's course on medieval women Latinists. And since I knew how to search archives, I sort of went looking. Well, you know, if there's that much women's activity before 1400, I'd be surprised if it just stopped, even though everybody says, oh, it just stopped. Well, why should it? So I kind of transformed myself gradually from a medievalist to an early modernist, just because it's sort of, you follow the money. I mean, you follow the stuff that nobody's looked at and nobody knows about.
Very good. That's inspiring for us all to go out there and look. And in your book itself, you trace the history of women Latinists as much as the historiography of women Latinists, which you sort of touched on then, talking about how there's been some study, or there was some study, of medieval women in Latin. And then people sort of had this narrative that it just stopped. So could you give us a little more about that historiography in the past 50 years or so, or over the course of your career?
Yes, well, when I guess Manuel, who edited, you know, the series editor for this book, asked me if I'd look at the historiography, and I realised that the key year is 1980. Sort of before that, there's a blank, and then sort of quite suddenly, that particular era of feminism got very interested in, you know, rediscovery. It produced things like the Virago Press and the Women's Press and so on, sort of, you know, the idea of sort of diving into archives and looking for women was very much sort of around in the early 80s. And then crucially in 1983, Margaret King and Alfred Rabil produce Her Immaculate Hand, which is a collection of stuff by Renaissance Italian women. So kind of the life moves on from that. And in 1993, you've got Chicago University Press's The Other Voice in Early Modern Europe, which was dedicated to discovering forgotten writing by women. Incredibly useful series. And if you're interested in English women writers, Betty Trevitsky started putting women Latinists in her series, The Early Modern English Women, in print. So, and yeah, and then another thing, perhaps not so much directly concerned with Latin, but I was concerned with it, the Perdita Project, which was looking for women's writing in manuscript. I mean, we found masses of stuff that nobody knew about. So yes, I mean, there's just this story of rediscovery sort of from about 1980 to 2000. And since then, mostly we've been sort of chewing it and trying to assess it and see how it changes the picture.
Thank you. And I know you've played a large role in that yourself with your other works, just bringing to light these women authors who were writing in manuscript and publishing and making that better known to such a broader segment of the population.
Yeah, it's my proud boast that I've spent an entire career writing about people that nobody ever heard of. The plus thing is that by the time I finished, they had heard of them, so that was fine. But
very good. Well, to turn to the contents of your new book, could you tell us a little bit about women and humanism in Renaissance Italy in particular? So when has the story usually begun? You know, if you look at a typical work on this topic, what date would that kind of relationship start? And what have you found in terms of when learned women actually start appearing in the historical record?
Right. Well, of course, the Renaissance is about the rediscovery of the classics, at which point it became clear that there were a number of women in the first century BC who left significant reputations as writers. So very little actually survives. We've got the poems of Sulpicia, but not much else. But anyway, the idea of learning for women, I think, partly comes out of the rediscovery of classical Latin. As it happened, if you go to King and Rabil, Her Immaculate Hand, which I mentioned from 1983, they focus on the mid 15th century generation, which includes women like Alessandra Scala, Isotta Nogarola, and Cassandra Fedeli, the so-called Maiden of Venice. So what they found essentially were a series of women who are sort of writing letters to each other and to men, but sort of mostly letters just saying, I think you're wonderful, and orations saying, I think so and so is wonderful. It's quite a dull body of material, to be honest. So then you get some people like Lisa Jardine sort of coming along looking at this and saying, actually, it's a damn dull body of material. The Renaissance woman is just a sort of ornament to her society. And, the productive purpose of this is somewhere around zero. I was starting from a rather different place, and what I realised is that by the time you get people like Cassandra Fedeli popping up, there'd been women studying Latin studying Latin seriously in the sort of humanist way for at least a generation, and possibly two. But very little of their what they produced survived, which is why King and Rabeel sort of focused on the people, you know, who had left a surviving oeuvre. And approaching this as a historian, it struck me that the wives of condottieri had to learn how to run a country, because a condottiere is a professional mercenary who's also a nobleman. And a condotta from the beginning of the 15th century would take you away from home, you know, running an army on behalf of somebody else for anything up to 2 years. Now, if you leave your own territories in charge of your brother, let's say, you may not get them back. If you can leave them in charge of your wife, she's the one person whose interests actually march directly along with yours. She's got the same stake you have in handing it on to your common children. So, you know, so with that in mind, the condottieri start educating their daughters. They start marrying educated women who are capable of writing a Latin letter, of creating a strategy, acting as diplomats, you know, all that kind of stuff. And because this was of absolutely direct practical use to them. So the first women Latinists in Renaissance Italy are highly functional. Unfortunately, their function was, you know, they were writing letters, but much of what they were achieving was purely oral. You know, the grand sort of diplomatic arts of persuasion. And so they don't leave a lot of evidence. And I think that's skewed the picture quite markedly.
So what we're seeing is really education for political use and oral use more than crafting an artful letter or something like that.
Yeah. And then what happens is that this sort of flows out of the circles where, you know, Latin is of utility, and you start to get the idea of the woman as the ornament of her society. So Cassandra Fedeli is addressed as O Decus Italiae Virgo, you know, mm-hmm. Virgin, the glory of Italy, and sort of, you know, a learned lady is a sort of totem figure for her society. And that's a kind of secondary development as far as I see.
Interesting. So how do you think that these earlier women, these women coming out of the condottieri households who are Latinate, how do you think they change the way that we look at the more famous female humanists of 15th century Italian Renaissance?
I think you have to nuance the sort of Lisa Jardine, Tony Grafton argument that you know, Latin for women was always useless, and say, actually, there are people for whom Latin is jolly useful. And what I find, you know, if you really sort of drill down, is that the sort of noble families I'm talking about go on educating their daughters for generations. So, you know, in the 16th century, Vittoria Colonna's the most famous mm-hmm. poet in Italy. I mean, she's much published. She's a friend of Michelangelo's. You know, she's a very sort of high profile figure. She's six generations down from Isotta Nogarola in direct descent. Every single generation between Isotta Nogarola and Colonna, you have educated Latin literate women, you know. So you get these sort of family traditions where they just go on doing it. And, you know, the purposes for which it is used, of course, changes with society more generally.
Yeah, thinking about society in general and the reception of these Latinate women in their own era, how did contemporary humanists like Leonardo Bruni or Martino Filatico respond to these women? Do we see pushback? Do we see praise? What's the response there?
Praise and welcome. There ought to be more of this. I mean, Bruni writes the first treatise on why women ought to be educated, and Philetico writes a work which is effectively in praise of Battista de Montefeltro, you know, the wife of the great Federigo. Humanists are partly doing this because they're strongly in favour of there being more jobs for humanists.
Ah, gotcha.
They will argue for more and better education at the drop of a hat. I mean, they'd argue for educating donkeys, you know, if they thought donkeys were capable of paying them. So the thing is that education is excellent. Education makes you more excellent in yourself. This is an absolutely key humanist tenet. But what it's trying to do is to ensure that more and more and more people with money are prepared to take a humanist into their household. So educating women is grist to the mill.
Very good. So
you find I can't think of a single humanist who says otherwise.
When it comes to money, I suppose they will do whatever it takes to get a job.
Well, it's highly competitive.
Yes.
You know, any humanist, you know, they want to get a university position. They want to be great man's secretary. They spend an awful lot of time just sort of oiling around anybody with money, and promoting education for women is, I think, just part of that package.
So that's the Italian context. Over in France, who do we see? What women do we see receiving a humanist education? And what seem to be their parents' motivations if we don't necessarily have that same condottieri set up, politically speaking, in France?
Well, absolutely. It absolutely starts with the court. And, generally speaking, the Italian Renaissance provides a sort of pattern which the rest of Europe finds powerfully interesting and attractive. You know, the new learning spreads out of Italy and carries with it ideas about mathematics and perspective and the Lord knows what, but also carries with it, just as part of the package, the idea that women should be educated. Now, in French context, the first women who do this and who find themselves a humanist and start learning are really the royal family.
Mm.
And they do it for the same reason that Battista de Montefeltro did, because they might end up in charge.
Hmm.
François Premier is imprisoned in Italy for a number of years. So, somebody has to act as his regent, and that somebody is almost invariably female.
Hmm.
So you find that, as the 15th century wears to an end, 16th century begins, women are occupying these sort of diplomatic roles where, command of persuasive language is really useful to them, but they're only at this very top level of society.
Hmm.
So, yes. So again, I'd see it as fundamentally practical.
Staying at that top level of society, could you take us to England and talk through I'm sure many people are familiar with the ups and downs of Tudor monarchs, but how those particular royals really impacted women's education more broadly beyond just Elizabeth and Mary receiving Latin educations? How did the makeup of the royal court allow opportunities for women to learn Latin?
Yeah, well, Henry VIII, I mean, he's very impressed by what's going on in France. So his court starts to become more humanist. And of course, he marries Catherine of Aragon, who was a highly educated Spanish princess. And, you know, it's, you know, after the arrival of Catherine of Aragon, Mary Tudor, that is to say Henry's sister, not his daughter, she starts to learn Latin in about 1520 because she can see the fashion has changed, and she does, in fact, briefly become Queen of France. So despite the fact that obviously, you know, Catherine ends up, you know, exiled and separated, she's brought with her a new sophistication in women's culture. So that remains the case. I mean, so Henry's last wife, Catherine Parr, I mean, was an educated woman. And she oversees the education of her stepchildren. Two short reigns, of course, Edward and Mary Tudor, they continue to be sort of, you know, humanistically directed. I mean, you know, you can't say that Edward the VI, who was only a young boy, had much to do with women Latinists, but his uncle, Seymour, who was the Lord Protector of England, effectively regent, he educated his three youngest daughters up to the nines, and they published a book of verse, a Latin verse, in Paris. So it's, you know, it's still obviously central to the culture. And Mary Tudor is the patron of Mary Bassett, who's the daughter of Margaret Roper, daughter of St. Thomas More. You know, she's so she is producing a culture that's fostering towards women Latinists. And then, of course, by the time you get to Elizabeth, you have this assumption that education, Latin education, knowing who Livy is, all this stuff, is part of throne worthiness. You know, anybody who's remotely likely to get near the throne or even marry a king is going to have a full humanist education. Unfortunately, of course, that changes under James, who has no interest in learning women whatsoever. In fact, he has no interest in women. So you see a marked difference by, you know, in the reign of James, learned ladies were not welcome at court. In fact, there continue to be learned ladies, but they're not occupying these sort of high-profile positions, not least, of course, because Latin is ceasing to be the principal diplomatic language. I mean, the education for a woman courtier in the 17th century is based in French. French is the fashionable language. So you know, this relates not just to rulers' personalities, but also to the place of Latin in the culture more generally.
Fascinating. The way that things can change and circumstances and people and style all impact this larger narrative. So that was France and England. You argue that Spain and Portugal, well, not argue, I'm sure you found in your research that Spain and Portugal have produced fewer learned women than other areas of Europe. And I wonder if you could talk about some of the factors that might have contributed to this lower amount of Latinate women.
Well, I think it's actually to do with the competing attraction of religion. Spain is the motor of the Counter-Reformation. I mean, sort of, you know, think of Philip II. And where the, you know, the really sort of clever and interesting dynamic women go is into the church. I mean, think of Teresa of Avila. You know, she's writing very powerfully in Spanish. But, you know, what women of real sort of capacity do is become nuns. You know, they become mystics. In the case of, say, Mary of Agreda, I mean, she She's the principal political advisor to Philip III, but she's a nun, and she's not a humanist.
So, and by this,
so it's a differently shaped culture in where humanism, in general, has less weight than it does in France or Italy.
And by this point, in convents in the Iberian Peninsula, had Latin lost its usefulness? I know, at least in the medieval era, we think of convents as this great resource for women's Latin access. But is that no longer the case by the 16th century?
Well, women have to understand enough about Latin to perform the liturgy, because, of course, mm-hmm. you know, the Eucharist and so on, those services are all in Latin. But their own writing, which is often extensive, I don't know of any Iberian convent which is, you know, any kind of a centre of Latin learning.
Mm.
They're not even translating from Latin. There's a few learned ladies knocking around the Spanish and Portuguese courts, but the culture as a whole just doesn't seem to find much of a place for these women.
Interesting. So we've been talking about women in courts at this highest level of society, but you also bring our attention to the fact that educated women in the 16th century begin to use their Latin professionally, that is, as part of waged labor. So could you talk more about what causes this development, and what sort of work we find Latinate women engaging in this era?
Yes, well, I think the two principal areas where you find learned women engaged in work, it's teaching and printing. Because teaching is obvious. One niche which develops, of course, is the woman teacher of some high-born girl or girls, where, you know, it might be considered safer, since the court eunuch had been abandoned as an institution, if your precious infanta is educated by another woman, like Luisa Seguer educating mm-hmm. the Infanta Maria, rather than entrusting her to a male tutor, which, you know, could cause all kinds of trouble. So women start turning up as educators or helping their fathers, humanist fathers, run a school, or sometimes even opening a school of their own. And as far as printing goes, well, the great majority of what's printed in the 16th century is, of course, in Latin, and hand press book printing is incredibly labor intensive. You know, printers marry the daughters of printers, because your wife needed to be able to sort of multitask, to, you know, mind the baby and stir the porridge and typeset a page, all as sort of part of the same day's work. So printers become a kind of clan, and it's assumed that women, you know, should be able to take up the slack. And you can't really typeset a page if you don't understand anything about what's on it, mm-hmm. because you've got to be able to read the manuscript that you're setting from.
So we could almost think of them as...
So that produces, learned women in sort of many corners of Europe.
Wonderful. So sticking with those printers for a second, they're almost like modern copy editors to some degree, where they need to be able to tell if the sentences make sense and the words are correct and... That would require having that knowledge.
If you think of it, there's somebody is sitting there with a manuscript. Not every humanist had a beautiful italic hand by any means, and they were also prone to using abbreviations. So you've got to be able to sort of look at what's in front of you and translate it, and you. Can't do that unless you recognize that DNS is short for Dominus. So yes, I mean, without Latin, you probably are going to make a complete mess of things.
Fascinating. So this has all been mostly focused on the 16th century, but you have encouraged scholars to look to the 17th century as well. You note that there's a general assumption that women Latinists kind of disappear after 1600, but you argue instead that, quote, throughout Europe, there are more women using Latin in the 17th than in the 16th century, and they do so for a wider range of purposes, end quote. Could you tell us a little bit about why we have failed to notice these 17th century women?
Well, yes, I think there's several reasons. One is about the general shape of culture. And after 1600, Europe's vernaculars are the principal means of literary expression in almost every country. Latin is increasingly the preserve of the universities, law and medicine, great masculine bastions that don't admit women. So the assumption is obviously women aren't going to be learning Latin. Also, I mean, think about the rise of the novel. There is an absolutely gigantic rise in the number and variety and interest of works authored by women after 1600, but in Europe's many vernaculars. So I think that's part of the answer. I mean, a sort of assumption that Latin doesn't really matter anymore. And, you know, if you want to work on women, you know, go off and work on Afrobain or somebody like that. And so it's a combination of, you know, what women are doing, you know, what most women are doing, and an assumption that Latin's just become a sort of, you know, outmoded bastion of certain professions. And people just stop looking, you know. You can do so, you know, there's so many interesting things about women's writing, and so why go looking for needles in haystacks? I think it really sort of pretty much comes down to that.
Well, it's encouraging for younger scholars to know that there's lots more out there to go look for. Sticking with the 17th century and this shift in attitudes and values, could you tell us a little bit about how the figure of the female prodigy, who you brought up earlier in our discussion of the Italian humanists, how this attitude changes in the 17th century, particularly amongst learned women themselves, these women who perhaps earlier would have been held up as the emblem for their city? How are they viewing themselves or presenting themselves in this language of prodigy?
Well, curiously, the woman prodigy as a phenomenon continues quite merrily through the 17th century. And because the Stuart court isn't that sort of place, you just don't, you know, it's not a phenomenon of the English world so much. And I must say the English speaking academy does tend to prefer looking at things in England by and large. So Bathsheba Machin, you know, who later became a schoolmistress, turned up at the Stuart court saying, you know, presented as a learned maid who could read and write sort of Greek and Hebrew and Latin and all the rest of it. And the king just looked at her and said, but can she spin? You know, so you can't be a high profile woman prodigy in England. There just isn't a niche. On the other hand, Anna Maria van Thormann in Utrecht is, you know, is what is probably the single most famous woman in the country. It's still happening in Italy. Elena Piscopio, who's the first person to take a PhD, which she does in 1678. Again, very high profile figure. Sor Juana Maria de la Cruz in Mexico is another of these sort of prodigious ladies. One thing that you really notice is that they are regarded as cultural capital. Mm. That although education for women is not greatly encouraged in the Dutch Republic, they're jolly proud of Anna Maria van Swamen. But you also find that the women who have something of this prodigy status very much take notice of each other. So Anna Maria is sort of writing letters and poems and encouragement to people like Marie de Gournay in France, Birgitte Thott, who's translating Seneca in Denmark. They're congratulating each other. There's very much a network. As you know, communications in the 17th century are much better. So they're writing letters to each other all over Europe, and in the case of Sor Juana de la Cruz, I mean, even beyond Europe.
Mm. So it's this expansion of women and networks and communication that's ongoing. So one of those women in the 17th century who you bring our attention to is Martha Marchina in Italy. And I am personally a big fan of her poetry. So I was wondering if you could introduce our listeners to her as well and talk about how her life really highlights some of the major arguments of your book as we expand our study of women and Latin beyond just the well-known figures of the 15th and 16th centuries.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about Martha Marchina is that she doesn't fit with the pattern woman Latinist of the 17th century. She's not a totem to her city, which is Rome. You know, she's not occupying a public high profile place. She's not a member of academies. All of the things. She's not writing letters to other women. All of the things I was just talking about as the typical, learned, phenomenal woman of that time. She's working class, and she's effectively an autodidact. Her mother died when she was seven, and her father, who made soap and sold brooms, so that, they're at an artisan level of society, he can't afford anybody to look after his two boys. So he essentially tells Martha Marchina to bring up her brothers. The brothers are sent to the oratory, the Chiesa Nova, which was sort of probably the nearest church to where they lived. It's certainly very near where we know the Marchina's shop was. And the oratory were a new order who specialised in the care of the urban poor, and oratorians took on charitable projects. So one of the oratorian fathers takes an interest in the boys and starts educating them. And when they go home to their sister, she refuses to feed them until they've disgorged what they've learned that day. so she learns Latin kind of secondhand. And the headmaster and, Ludovico Santolino, he calls on Marchino's father and sort of says, your sons are beginning to interest me. Because, of course, by the time they've explained everything to Martha, I mean, they must have been phenomenally well prepared for schoolboys. I mean, they had to. I mean, they were effectively learning and teaching at the same time. So, my guess is that Sandalino was thinking that, these kids are so, committed to learning. I wonder if we might be sponsoring them into a seminary to become priests, which is a major form of upward mobility in 17th century Rome. Anyway, Marcino says, well, I don't know anything about that. You'll have to ask Martha, at which point Santolino discovers that, you know, Martha is sitting at home, desperate for books, learning as much Latin as she possibly can. And in fact, the Oratorians take her under their wing. They start lending her books. They help her with her education. They try without success to think of something to do with her. I mean, does she want to run a school? No, she doesn't. Does she want to become a nun? No, actually, she doesn't. Does she want a university chair? No, she really doesn't. Again, it would be horribly exposed. And so, you know, she is socially quite beyond her. So basically, she doesn't marry. Her own profession is as a gold embroiderer, for which there was a tremendous ready market in 17th century Rome, you know, making beautiful things for the altar, you know, chalice veils, all that sort of stuff. And so she sits in the attic, embroidering with gold and thinking about, well, picking a subject for meditation while she sews. And I think she's sort of stitching and thinking, and produces these short, intense, reflective religious poems, you know, based on her morning's meditation. I mean, it puts her embroidery down, you know, picks up a pen and writes it down, you know, once it's clear in her mind. And So she's taken under the wing of these Spadas, who are themselves a family that's sort of risen from nowhere, from a little place called Brisighella. And so by the time Martha Marcino attracts their attentions, there's a Spada who's become a cardinal, and there are several more cardinals in the family. And the work that we have of Marcina's is essentially preserved by the Spadas. She's a protege of theirs. She dies young at 43 of a fever, but then in 17th century Rome, people did, because, you know, fever was endemic. I mean, you just caught typhus off the Tiber. She was much respected. She was taken completely seriously as a poet. And, you know, she had her own little social niche, which was essentially with cultivated churchmen. So a very peculiar story, not what anybody's expecting at all, but she is a very good poet.
Yeah, I would encourage anyone who's interested to look at her poems. We're talking right now in the build up to Christmas, and she has some lovely ones that have that meditative effect that you were discussing. She just returns to those themes again and again. So Martha Marcina, 17th century woman in Latin, changing the way that we have often thought about it. But your book doesn't limit itself to the 17th century, and you write about women in the 18th and 19th century, and again, just this flourishing of women Latinists. Could you tell us a little bit about what the relationship between women and Latin looks like in these latter two centuries?
Yes, well, I think by the time you get to the 18th century, women are learning Latin because they really want to. You get some people like, say, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, yeah, a famously inquiring mind, you know, one of the people who introduced vaccination to Europe, you know, interested person. Well, by the time she's 11, she's rummaging around in her father's library teaching herself Latin. So that's the sort of person who decides they want to learn Latin. One very interesting development of the 18th century is that women start learning Latin or teaching themselves Latin because they're interested in science. So you get women astronomers. You get you start getting women doctors, you get women mathematicians. There's a number of women, most notably the Marquise de Châtelet, who's a particular friend of Voltaire's. Marquise de Châtelet produces the standard translation into French of Newton's Principia. A very difficult text. There's several women who are extremely interested in Newton, you know, in the what's the sort of cutting edge physics of the 17th century. So yes, I mean there are contexts like botany, these new sciences, where women are sort of intellectually attracted, and Latin is a means to an end. And you start getting women knocking on the doors of the professions. There's a woman in Germany who persuades Peter the Great to let her join the medical school at Halle. So it's a special dispensation. And in order to do so, she has to be able to write and defend a Latin thesis, which she does. But another thing you get, which really comes out of this sort of salon culture of 17th century France, is that women start taking up places as public intellectuals. And I'm thinking of people like, Hannah More or Madame Lafayette. If you sort of drill down into their past, you'll very often find that they were Latin literate, that that their appearance as public figures, writing published essays or whatever it is based or buttressed by the fact that they're thoroughly educated. So in the 19th century, I'd point to George Eliot. Deeply famous for, obviously, as a novelist, studied by, studied in every university English department in the world. But students of George Eliot aren't necessarily even told that when she was still a young woman called Marian Evans, she was translating the philosopher Baruch Spinoza. Again, very difficult work in Latin. So yes, I mean, women are using Latin as a means to an end. Either they want some kind of a public position, as an essayist or somebody that journalists come to for opinion, or they want to enter a profession, or they want to study physics, that sort of reason. And if you do want to study physics or something, it's you learn Latin, that's taken totally for granted, so nobody ever mentions it.
So women Latinists are still here, still there, and doing interesting things, even if it's different than
what happened. By the end of the 19th century, the universities start opening to women, so classics departments start acquiring women, and there is since then a legion of women have done distinguished work on Latin.
Well, as a senior scholar in the field, what are your hopes for the study of Latinate women going forward?
I could answer that in one word: editing. two words, and translating. When I was working on a book I wrote many years ago, Women Latin Poets, I was drowning in women Latinists. I couldn't stop, I was trying to produce an overview, but I kept coming across some, sizable and interesting literary production, thinking somebody must edit this. Some, why has nobody edited Willa Trudis, who was a 12th century English abbess who wrote one of the most feminist works of the 12th century, which is a long poem about Susanna and the elders. You know, it's a completely countercultural document, you know, and that's never been edited. You know, there's miles of stuff that nobody's looked at. You're saying Marquina, I mean, really interesting poet, really interesting life. And, you know, some people are starting to look at Marquina, but there is not at the moment an edition with facing page translation, and one is desperately needed. Yes, I mean, you know, pick an author and do something about her is what I would advise any younger woman who wants to get into working on women Latinists.
Well, encouraging words for those listening who are interested. Jane, it's really been lovely talking with you today. A final question before we sign off is, how has your work on women in Latin in the early modern period led you in new directions for research? Or are you yourself taking up the editing and translating task? What's on the horizon for you these days?
Well, I'm actually in rather different directions. In 2000, I moved to Aberdeen, where I was Regis Chair, and I'm now in Oxford. But Aberdeen is a very interesting place, and I got very interested in Scottish Latin literature and the distinctiveness of the Scottish literary tradition. And since doing all this stuff about women Latinists, I've also done a lot about, the humanist culture of Scotland. And another area that I got into was recusants. Mm. I was interested in exiles. And so I've been doing a lot of work on the sort of Catholic counterculture of the early modern, and in particular on the interior lives of women in one way or another. So, kind of one thing leads to another, but it doesn't necessarily kind of lead to the next step on the path with women in Latin. You know, just it all weaves in and out, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to reading whatever you produce next, and learning more from you about what you discover. Again, thank you so much, Jane, for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation. And to our audience, thank you for joining us for this discussion of Women and Latin in the Early Modern Period by Jane Stevenson. I've been your host, Elspeth Curry, and you've been listening to New Books in Early Modern History. Take care.